We had a lively interest in whatever the administration was doing with respect to church and state.
This is something that we fought hard for.
Religious liberty is one of the hallmarks and part of the bedrock of American democracy.
We at the BJC like to say when anyone's religious liberty is threatened, everyone's religious liberty is at risk.
Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. I'm Amanda Tyler, the Executive Director of the BJC, and I'm here today with Walter B. Sherden, otherwise known to Baptists everywhere as Buddy, who established with his wife Kay our annual Sherden Lectures. It's so good to visit with you today, Buddy.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you as well, always.
Well, earlier this year, we were together in Georgia for the annual Walter B. and K.W. Sherden Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. We heard their presentations from Dr. Charles C. Haynes, who is the founding director of the Religious Freedom Center of the Newseum Institute. And we'll hear one of his lectures in just a minute. But I wanted to talk with you first, Buddy, about the lectures. For those who are listening and might be new to the Sherden Lectures, tell us why you and Kay decided to endow these more than 10 years ago now.
Well, I have, I'm a church historian in background, and much of my research and work has been done in the area of Baptist studies. And I've always had, for some reason, a very special place for freedom of conscience. I wrote some seminar papers on it when I was in graduate school on some people like Isaac Backus and John Leland and Thomas Helwys. So I suppose my educational background shaped me to some degree. And Kay and I had hosted Brent quite often when he came down for some seminars that we had at Mercer. And we got to talking more and more about the Baptist Joint Committee, and I realized that it was just one of the most crucial and critical religious organizations that we have in this country to safeguard the freedoms of conscience and of religious freedom that we have. And I suppose I was the one who took the initiative and talked with Kay about it, and she was glad to be partner in it. And so we called Brent and asked him to come down, or he was coming down to Macon, Georgia, where we live. And when he came down, we talked to him about this proposal that we had of having the Sherden Lectures on religious liberty at various venues annually. So all of it comes out of this interest that I have in Baptist studies and what I have sensed to be such a significant issue in Baptist life. But it's not just Baptist. Religious liberty is important for all people everywhere and for all citizens in our country. And because of its sort of universal nature, we thought it was a good place to pop down some of our interest and commitments, and that's why we did it.
Well, we at the Baptist Joint Committee are so grateful for your vision and your generous philanthropy for these lectures. I know Brent Walker, my predecessor as executive director here at the BJC, was incredibly touched by this gift, and it's my honor to be able to continue these lectures. This year was our 13th annual year, and they will go on for years and years to come for many more generations of students to learn. Well, in just a moment, we'll be hearing from Dr. Charles Haynes as he gives his second lecture from this year's series called Standing Up for Justice in Conflict in an Age of Division. Buddy, you heard this lecture in person this year. What struck you about Dr. Haynes' message?
Well, two things struck me about it. One, it was not so much, well, it's related to content, But, you know, it's easy for a lecturer to get on the circuit and to give canned lectures, and Charles's lecture was anything but canned. He had done research on what had happened at Mercer in the last year. We had some religious freedom issues to pop up on campus. He knew about those issues. He knew about our president, who's a lawyer, and a former intern at the Baptist Joint Committee, I should say, Bill Underwood. And I was really impressed that he came not with just ideas about religious freedom and religious liberty, but that he came speaking to our particular situation and our context. That was the first thing. I think the second thing that struck me was how he addressed himself to the students and their understanding or lack of understanding of freedom of conscience, and how important their affirmation of freedom of conscience was to them, and therefore for all of the people. I'm not sure we've ever had a lecture that I've heard, and I haven't heard all of them, but the ones I've heard, I'm not sure that I've ever heard a lecture that was just so pointedly targeted to the students and calling them to embrace the great idea of freedom of conscience. I just thought he did a fabulous job with it.
Well, I certainly agree, and I'm so pleased that we're going to be able to share that lecture on this podcast, and hope that many more students who weren't able to be at Mercer this spring with us can listen to it and be inspired as we look to the next generation really to lead us as we protect religious freedom.
I think I may have sent you a letter, I hope I did, Amanda, of a student who had been at the lecture. And he had been there because the professor in a certain class in religion had urged them to come to the lecture. And when he went back to his class, he wrote up a summary of the lecture. And I read the summary. It was a marvelous summary of the lecture. And in his letter to the professor responsible for him attending, he said it was the best lecture that he had ever attended at Mercer University.
Well, there's no better testimonial than that, I would think, to really know that it struck a chord with the students as well as others who were present for it. Well, many people in the Baptist world know you as the author of Four Fragile Freedoms, which is a book on Baptist identity. One of those freedoms is religious liberty, which, of course, is our focus here at the Baptist Joint Committee. Why is, in your words, religious liberty such an important Baptist distinctive?
Well, it is important for at least two reasons in terms of our background. Number one, Baptists were born in adversity. When Baptists came into existence in the 17th century, they came into a world of religious discrimination and religious persecution. And that was true both in England and in New England. There was as much religious discrimination in this country as there was in Old England. And so early Baptists in the 17th century had to struggle for their voices to be heard. And that continued into the 18th and into the 19th century. As you know, it was not until 1833 that the last state church was disestablished in this country. So we've had a long period of time in American history when Baptists were sort of under the heels of both state and, in some instances, church. So the first reason it's important is because we were born in such adversity, religious adversity. The second reason it's important is because Baptists have some ideas that automatically lead to religious freedom. And those ideas are, several of which are these. Number one, God made all humans free. Number two, to deny human freedom to God's highest creation, humanity, is to defame that creation. Number three, the church has to be a gathered church rather than a state church, and it has to be free to run its own affairs. And another emphasis that early Baptists had, and I think it's continued throughout the world, and that is that Christ is the lawgiver and king and president of the church, not Caesar, not the government, not the president, not the prime minister. So those two ideas, that they were born in adversity and that they came to life with ideas that guaranteed freedom not simply for themselves, but for all people. One of the earliest documents we have by Thomas Helwes, called The Mystery of Iniquity, he was trying to defend the right of Roman Catholics as well as Baptists, and that has been the tradition of Baptists historically. I think we've stubbed our toe in the last several years in thinking that religion is only for certain groups, or religious freedom is only for certain groups. But historically, one of the charming and attractive things about Baptist life is their argument for religious freedom for all people. I'm glad to say that the Baptist Joint Committee, so far as I know, is certainly the only organization in America founded and supported by Baptists who advocate religious freedom and freedom of conscience for all people. One of the most attractive things about the Baptist Joint Committee is its ecumenical nature and the way it partners with all peoples to find religious freedom for all people. So I think religious liberty has been at the heart of Baptist life. In fact, I've often said that before Baptists got concerned about theological education or religious education, and before they got concerned about missions, they were concerned about religious freedom. And that torch stayed alive till well into the 20th century, and we may see it blinking a little bit in the most recent years, but that means that organizations like the Baptist Joint Committee and the advocacy of freedom of conscience is even more important.
Thank you, Buddy. Now let's hear one of those lectures. Here's Dr. Charles C. Haynes, the founding director of the Religious Freedom Center of the Newseum Institute, speaking as part of the 2018 Sheridan Lectures. This lecture is called Standing Up for Justice and Freedom in an Age of Conflict and Division.
Now, don't tell the theology school where I spoke yesterday or the law school where I'm going this afternoon, but this is the talk I really wanted to give. Don't tell them that because it'd be disappointing. And the reason for that is because I want to talk a little bit this morning about liberty of conscience and the power of conscience. And it's because my entire career has been committed to defending the rights of conscience for people of all faiths and of no faiths. And I have to say often it's been defending people that I don't like or I disagree with deeply. But, you know, I think that conscience and the freedom to follow our conscience is the most important civic principle, the most important constitutional principle in our arrangement in liberty. So that's why I wanted to talk about it. The power of conscience is, as I'm sure you know, the power to stand up for justice, for freedom, against great odds. Now, let's be timely and consider the student-initiated, student-led protests that will be filling our public squares this coming Saturday. I read somewhere that there are over 800 such gatherings planned in the United States and some 70 throughout the world. I suspect there'll be maybe millions of people pouring into the streets, all organized by some high school students out of Florida. So once again, as at many other moments in our nation's history, students, young people, are stirring the nation's conscience. And whether you're happy about it or not, and that, of course, depends on where you stand on the whole gun control issue, these students have done more in 1 month to advance the national dialogue on guns than political and religious leaders have been able to accomplish in decades. So how is this possible? Because I would argue the Parkland students and their supporters have figured out the secret sauce of social change in America, at least for those of us who don't have millions of dollars to hire lobbyists and high-priced lawyers. And that is, get out there, right? And getting out there today includes effective use of social media. And put your First Amendment freedoms to work. Follow your conscience, raise your voice, and in the words of John Lewis, make some noise. When you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, Lewis frequently tells young people, you have a moral obligation, a mission, and a mandate to stand up, speak out, and get in the way. Get in trouble. Good trouble. Necessary trouble. Dean, I hope I'm not going to cause any trouble this morning. But that's what he said. Now, as much as their critics don't like to hear it, these Parkland students are not paid actors. They're not stooges of George Soros, and they're not too young to know anything about public policy. The survivors of the massacre at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School have figured out that, like every other American, they have fundamental rights to liberty of conscience, free speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, freedom of petition, the five freedoms protected by the First Amendment that have been employed in every important social movement in American history. Now, it's true, as one angry Florida legislator pointed out, adults make laws. But young people, and remember, there's no age limit on inalienable rights, can challenge those laws and demand new ones to bring about the change they seek. The odds may seem long, but if I were a betting man, I would not bet against these students. And the message of the protest is so powerful because it is a call to conscience shaped by witness to violent deaths of friends and classmates. And hearing some of these students speak over the last month reminds me of what is at stake in maintaining an open and free public square where all claims of conscience are expressed and heard. This is why I got into the First Amendment business in the first place. Now, the gun control debate, obviously, is not a religious issue. Well, maybe it is for some people who advocate gun rights, but generally, we don't think of it as a religious issue. But for many of these students, it is a cause of conscience. Following your conscience in America is made possible by what we call the religion clauses of the First Amendment. See, Buddy and Kay were waiting to me. Are you going to get to the First Amendment religion clauses, or are you just going to? And yes, I am, and here we are. I'm going to say that I know this is counterintuitive. Many of you think of the First Amendment and religion clauses as being all about religion, but actually, I think they're better named the religious freedom or liberty of conscience clauses, because together the two provisions, no establishment and free exercise, have created the civic framework for the first time in human history in which people are able to debate one another when we use them, negotiate our differences, and where possible, find a common vision for the common good. The no establishment principle, also known sometimes as separation of church and state, ensures that America has no official orthodoxy. We take this so for granted that we forget this, that for most of human history, that was the barrier to conscience being expressed. No more, not here. As is the case in many other countries around the world, there is an official orthodoxy, and we see the result. And the free exercise principle ensures, or is supposed to ensure, a level playing field for people of all faiths or no faiths in our public square. As a result, we in this country are free to follow the highest authority in our lives. And for most religious people, and for humanists, for others, that is our conscience, not the state. We are free, in other words, to do what our conscience dictates we must do. It's not just about what we want to do, or what we like to do. I mean, how many times a day have you, you know, wanted to do something, but your conscience says, well, no, maybe you shouldn't. I mean, that probably happens pretty frequently. So there is a difference between just what we'd like to do and what we really have to do, because it is a deep claim. Maybe it's our God. Maybe it's our deep philosophical commitment. And that, Madison and Jefferson argued, has to be the first freedom. You have to allow people to follow what they feel they must do. The duty to our conscience, wrote James Madison, is precedent both in degree and time and degree of obligation to the claims of civil society. The role of government is to protect the right of people to follow their conscience as far as possible. Think of this. Founding a nation based on the idea that there's a higher authority in people's lives than the government. It's a radical thing to do, and we did it. We don't live up to it always, but we did it. So it is important to underscore here that the American arrangement in religious liberty is not just for the religious. It is liberty of conscience for people of all faiths or no faith. Some of you may recall Thomas Jefferson's Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. I'm required by law as a Virginian, every time I speak publicly about religious freedom, to mention Jefferson at least once, preferably twice, and so I have filled my quota by this quote right here. But you may remember that his, because all good things come out of Virginia, you may remember that his famous bill for disestablishing religion begins, "Whereas God Almighty hath created the mind free." Those are the opening words. And then everything that follows says, well, unless you separate church from state, unless you keep government out of the religion business, I'm paraphrasing slightly, you don't have freedom of conscience or religious liberty. It isn't just some limitation on government, the Establishment Clause, it is the condition for freedom of conscience, a lesson most of the world has still yet to learn. So after the enactment of this Virginia statute, James Madison, who led the effort, of course, to pass the bill, wrote to Jefferson in France, and I love this, it's so optimistic. He wrote to Jefferson and he said, "The enacting clauses passed without a single alteration, and I flatter myself have in this country extinguished forever the ambitious hope of making laws for the human mind." Well, that's a bit optimistic, and we know that has not really worked out too well, but it's still our vision, it's still our ideal, isn't it? Isn't that still what we aspire to make sure that we don't pass laws for the human mind? Let me hasten to add, because I know some of you may be thinking this, no right, including liberty of conscience, is absolute, right? And rare instances, government can and must draw the line on actions that flow from conscience, religious or otherwise. The question of line drawing has been before the Supreme Court, as many of you know, many, many times. And it is again this term in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. If you're not familiar with that case, it's the baker, the wedding vendor who didn't want to bake the cake for the same-sex couple, and it's all the way up to the Supreme Court. I just want to say that if we did this better in this country, there would not be cases going up to the Supreme Court like this. We would work it out, but we didn't, we haven't, and so it is. Sometimes it has to. It goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, and we can talk more about that case later. I don't want to get into the recipe of the cakes and so forth at this moment, but that is an example of the court is now trying to figure out where to draw the line, and sometimes there's a balancing act, right? It's between, you know, these claims of religious freedom by the baker and, of course, non-discrimination laws that protect that same-sex couple on the other side in places of public accommodation, and these two are clashing in this case. So whatever you think of where that should come out, the balancing act is complicated, it's difficult, But in stark contrast to most places in the world, our government is mandated by the First Amendment to the Constitution to do everything possible to protect conscience. It doesn't mean conscience wins. It means we try to protect conscience, not because we agree with the claim or disagree, but because we understand that unless we protect the right people to follow the dictates of their conscience, today it will be us that won't be allowed to follow our conscience tomorrow. You know, if you want to measure the degree of freedom in a society, the degree to which claims of conscience, religious, secular, or otherwise, can be proclaimed in our public in a public square or in the courts, parachute yourselves into a public square in any country, right? And if you do that, and you see signs, you know, you see petitions, you hear sermons, right? You hear speeches. If, in short, it's a loud, crowded, contentious place, then you know you have landed in a society with a pretty high degree of freedom. Tragically, open and free public squares are becoming all too rare in the world today. Fully three-fourths of the world's people, this is stunning to me, this is according to Pew, didn't make this up, three-fourths of the world's people live in places with high, very high restrictions on liberty of conscience. This is not a problem of the Middle Ages, folks, this is a problem today. Repression of conscience, and this includes religious and non-religious conscience. Atheists are persecuted in many places just as much as religious people. Denying people the right to follow their God or their deepest convictions is the leading cause of conflict and violence throughout the world. Now, it goes without saying that not all claims of conscience are worthy or noble. If you were thinking that I was going to skip over that, it's true. Some of them are offensive. Or you find offensive, or I might find offensive, some are odious. But having said that, even claims we find offensive have the right to be heard. After all, history teaches that what is hate speech for one may be religious conviction for another. And as we have repeatedly discovered in this country, today's cult is tomorrow's mainstream religion. So as much as it pains me to defend the indefensible, Westboro protesters, you know, the Westboro Baptist Church, I'm sorry they use the name Baptist, I apologize, it's not my fault, but there you are. It's a terrible use of the name, but there they claim it. As long as they stay within the law, people like that, the extreme voices, have the same First Amendment rights as everybody else. And of course, I'm greatly heartened when counter-protesters vastly outnumber the Westboro pickets and drown them out, as American University students did a number of years ago in Washington, D.C. That is how freedom is supposed to work in a democracy. Here's the thing. If we grant government the power to shut down one person's speech today, we grant government the power to shut down our speech tomorrow. As challenging as this arrangement in freedom can be, I'm convinced that the only thing worse than an uncivil society is a society where government determines what is civil. So, at moments in our history, noble claims of conscience, ones I would call noble, advocates for religious freedom, racial justice, peace, sometimes discover the First Amendment is not sufficient, at least as it's currently applied. Their First Amendment freedoms won't bring about the change they seek, because sometimes laws keep them from exercising those freedoms. Sometimes the laws are unjust, and sometimes the First Amendment is interpreted to keep them from exercising their freedoms. And so, in that case, there's often civil disobedience. I'm sorry, we're getting into more trouble territory here. Civil disobedience. Students in last week's walkout, if you remember, some of them got a taste of what this tradition of civil disobedience actually looks like when you protest, and not everybody wants you to do so. In some cases, students have been suspended. I read a case where one student was suspended for 7 days for walking out for 17 minutes. You know? And in other cases, some schools tried to lock them in. Can you imagine? I saw one wonderful image on Twitter where students were breaking through the fence, right? The wire fence to get out to protest, and they did. To its credit, the Parkland School District, as far as I can tell, what I've read, has long encouraged their students to use their voice, which is what I think all school districts should do. Should say, hey, good for you, 17 minutes outside to demonstrate that you have civic virtue and you care about something, whatever we think of it, good for you. Hey, our civics class has worked. Oh, no, because unfortunately, a lot of our public schools and too many of our colleges and universities have become places where the First Amendment has gone to die. Truthfully, think about that for the future of our country. The very place where the First Amendment is supposed to be understood, exercised, where we practice our First Amendment rights when we're young, you know, in this laboratory of freedom, well, there is no First Amendment. Religious liberty of many students has been violated in these places. Student press has been censored. Petitioning has been outlawed. Free speech has been confined, and this is one of my favorite bete noirs in this whole field, to free speech zones. Excuse me. The whole campus is a free speech zone, or should be. Now, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Mercer students, but from what I've gathered, Mercer University does not appear to be such a place. Because I read, speaking to students in 2016, I read that President Underwood gave this commitment to freedom of expression. He said, it's not the role of the university to shield you from ideas and opinions that you find disagreeable or that even you find deeply offensive. It is our role to help you learn how to engage productively with those with whom you disagree, and that's sometimes difficult. Good for President Underwood, good for Mercer. Now, what this means in practice is often complex and contentious. Now, Mercer found that out, last month, when you invited Jay Sekulow for the Founders Day address, right? I don't know, you personally didn't invite him, but I mean, whoever it was that was responsible for inviting people to address. Now, Jay Sekulow, as most of you by now know, of the American Center for Law and Justice. I've known Jay a long time, so I hope he won't mind me speaking of him. If he's listening by live stream, hi, Jay. I doubt that very seriously. So I suspect that there's still a lot of disagreement on this campus about whether or not he should have been invited in the first place, right? So there's always going to be this disagreement. But what I would say is that the silent protests by students during his speech and the robust exchanges during the question and answer session were great examples for me of how freedom should work on a university campus. Now, I don't know if that's the right characterization. I wasn't here, but that's what I read. And the students of the campus LGBTQ student organization, Common Ground, I don't know if any of those members are here today, but they followed their conscience by speaking out and calling attention to those who are often marginalized and ignored. You know, it's fine to have free speech, but if you don't remember that people are affected by that speech, if you don't stand up and say something, not necessarily shut down the speech, but say something, then you really are not using your conscience, yourself. As McPherson Newell, who was leader of the group, put it, I read that McPherson said, our purpose was never to make them reverse the decision or prevent him from speaking, meaning Sekulow, but we were trying to call attention to the fact that what he represents isn't all what all of Mercer represents. Good. For those students. Good for Mercer. History teaches that when students follow their conscience, they have great power. They have great power. You know, it's forgotten sometimes by all of us that in 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King was, his effort to desegregate Birmingham, Alabama was faltering. It was failing, right? People weren't interested. He couldn't get attention to it. He even went to jail. Civil disobedience. Maybe the greatest example of civil disobedience in American history. Letter from a Birmingham jail. So you know what he did. In an effort to revive the cause of desegregation in Birmingham, he reluctantly, he and his team, decided to recruit students. Young students, college students, high school students, some were even younger. And this is what he said. He said, I'm doing this because I hope to subpoena the conscience of the nation to the judgment seat of morality. Isn't that wonderful? And so hundreds of college and high school students, some younger, signed up to learn about direct nonviolent action. They gathered at the 6th Street Baptist Church and marched downtown. Hundreds were arrested. And then hundreds more showed up. And when the infamous Bull Connor blasted them with fire hoses, ordered police officers to club them, and put police dogs on them to attack them, the resulting images on television and in newspapers sparked condemnation from around the world. Just a fun fact for you basketball fans. Do we have any basketball fans? The president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, which now is a famous school for having defeated Virginia, cursed them. No, I have no dog in that hunt, but they did. Wasn't University of Virginia number one seed? Yeah, see, you all know more than I do, but I do know something about it. I know that was a big deal, that this school out of nowhere comes and defeats the number one. Well, the reason I mention it is the president of University of Maryland, Baltimore County University, Dr. Freeman Habrosky, was 12 years old when he volunteered to participate in the Birmingham action. His parents said, oh, I don't think it's a good idea. He said, I gotta do this. 12 years old. And he went to jail. They put him in jail, 12 years old, for 5 days. And believe me, the Birmingham jail was not the most pleasant place to be. Just a fun footnote to history. And here he is leading this university today and doing great work, actually, in education, not just on the basketball. What do you call it? It's not a field, it's a court. I knew I'd get it. Give me a moment. I'm not quite that bad. And he remembers Dr. King saying to him, Freeman was his name, is his name. So Freeman, because he was the first in his family to truly be free, his parents thought, so they called him Freeman. Dr. King said to them, what you do this day will have an impact on generations yet unborn. So that courageous action by Freeman and those other students, it led to a settlement with the city in which Birmingham agreed to desegregate its stores, to release all the protesters from jail. And that success in Birmingham was a very important stepping stone to eventually passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Students. And history is replete with students of conscience like these students in Parkland in Birmingham. Students who have stood up for justice and freedom, and by doing so profoundly changed our society. I can't help but mention a couple of them because they're such amazing. Billy Gobitis, the Jehovah's Witness in West Virginia, you might have read about him. He was in fifth grade when he refused to salute the flag. And his parents said, I know it's against our conscience, but don't do that because you'll get in trouble, you'll get suspended, and we want you to have an education. And Billy Gobitis, a fifth grader, said, oh no. He had heard on the radio the head of Jehovah's Witnesses International talk about saluting Hitler. This is in the 30s. And he said, and the president of Jehovah's Witnesses says, we don't do that, even if it means we go to jail. And Billy Gobitis heard this, and he said, why am I saluting the flag every day, which is against our religion? You know, in those days, you didn't salute the flag by putting your hand over your heart. You salute your flag by this. And so this was chilling to Billy Gobitis, and he didn't want to do it, and he didn't do it, and he and some others were suspended. They sued, their families sued. They went all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States, and they lost. They lost. The Supreme Court, it was wartime after all, said, oh no, you got to do it, you know, whether it violates your conscience or not. One of the worst Supreme Court decisions in history. Fortunately, 3 years later, the Supreme Court had the wisdom to reverse itself in the Barnett decision, another Jehovah's Witness case, a flag salute case. And in the Barnett decision, the court said, we got it wrong. Coercion in matters of conscience is not what our flag stands for. Our flag stands for freedom of conscience. You know, by not saluting the flag, Billy Gobitis was upholding the principles the flag stands for. What is the matter with us when we criticize people like Colin Kaepernick for, you know, protesting at a football game? Realize what he's doing is saying, this is what I believe the flag stands for, racial justice. Well, doesn't it? Man. Or consider Mary Beth Tinker. Now, she was just a high school student in 1965, and some of you know her story. She still comes to the museum where I work in Washington, D.C., and talks to students, and she's an amazing person. She went to the medical field, but she, in her spare time, is out there pushing freedom of conscience. And she defied the school authorities in Des Moines, Iowa, right? All she wanted to do, she and her brother and a few others, was wear an armband. Didn't want to scream or just wanted to wear a black armband. They said, oh, no, can't do that, you know? They didn't want anybody standing up against the Vietnam War. Now, I'm getting close to home here because that was one of the causes that I put myself on the line for. But all she wanted to do was just wear an armband. And they said, you can't do it. And she said, this is America. And she and her family took it all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. And as many of you know, the Tinker decision in 1969 by the Supreme Court of the United States is the high watermark for student rights in America. It's the famous case that said students and teachers do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse door. The Tinker decision. But my favorite example, the last one I'll mention, is Barbara Johns. I don't know if you know the story of Barbara Johns, but just briefly I'll tell you, because this is inspiring to me every day. Barbara Johns was only 16 years old in 1951, when her conscience was outraged by looking down the street at the white school. They had textbooks, right? They had ceilings, and they had, you know, decent teaching. And she looked around her school, and they had to use umbrellas in some classes to keep the rain off of them. They had old hand-me-down textbooks way out of date, and they were meeting in, you know, trailers for classes. And she said, this is not right. This is not right in America. So you know what she did, and I'm not necessarily recommending this tactic to all of you, but, you know, civil disobedience. She had a false phone call to the school, a fake phone call to get the principal out of the school. Then she went into the assembly and had a fake note sent to all the classes to show up at the assembly. And everybody showed up, and she took it over. She took it over. 16 years old, and she said, this is not right, and we're going to go on. She told the teachers, you can leave now, and they did. And she told the students, we are going on strike, and we are not going to come back to this school until things change. And so they did. At one point, she took her shoe off and started pounding the podium. She was so agitated about it, and she said, enough is enough. Now, the reason I tell you this story is not just because what a brave young woman. Her classmates and Barbara suffered threats and intimidation, but that act of conscience, their acts of conscience, became one of the four consolidated cases that went to the Supreme Court in 1954 and ended with the decision in Brown versus Board of Education that desegregated America's schools and changed our country forever. 16-year-old Barbara Johns, Brown versus Board of Education. Just think of that. Whenever people tell you next time, oh, those kids, they can't do anything, just tell them about Barbara Johns. Now, Barbara received death threats, and the family had to send her off to Montgomery, Alabama, with relatives to finish her education. But a footnote to this, her school district closed the doors, closed down rather than accept the Supreme Court's decision. So they didn't have any options for education, and a lot of her classmates never got an education because of that. Guess what? Her white classmates? Oh, suddenly there were plenty of alternatives. You know, these private schools just opened up and they got an education, you know, because, well, white. But she changed the country. She suffered, they suffered, paid a price for their civil disobedience, but they made life better for all of us. Now, there are many more of these stories, which I could tell you, I won't, but these students, including many students today in colleges and universities that are on the front lines, for example, of fighting Islamophobia. I mean, it's incredible to see the students in a place like Murfreesboro, Tennessee, organize a whole religious freedom movement to fight back when the mosque, the people in the town said, we don't want a mosque or an Islamic center built here, right? And some vandals burned the property where they were building the mosque. And, you know, there was all this pressure and hatred to keep the mosque from getting zoning. And guess what? The local students at Middle Tennessee State University said, that's not America. They organized and they got a whole movement going, an interfaith movement. And guess what? That center is now up and running. Thanks to, in large part, to those students. Far from being too young to make a difference. Students who follow their conscience have always been and are now our nation's best hope for changing what is wrong and unjust in this society and societies around the world. So let me end with the last speech of Dr. Martin Luther King, an excerpt from that. This was delivered the day before he was assassinated. And he was talking specifically that day about the students who sat in 1960 at the lunch counters. We forget that although many of them were college students initially, when the college students went home in the summer, they had to get the high school students in there to sit on those lunch counters. And they sat on those lunch counters. They were spat on. They were knocked off. They were called names. And they got back up and sat again. And they changed America. So this is what he said the day before he was killed. He said, when students all over the South started sitting in at lunch counters, I knew that as they were sitting in, they were really standing up for the best in the American dream. They were taking the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. So students of Mercer University, let that be said of you. Our country needs your conscience. Our country needs your voice, your action, now, more than it, I would say, any time in our recent history. Follow your conscience, raise your voice, petition your government, work to create a more just and free society. Please help us restore the moral compass in this country that we appear to have lost. Even in humanity's darkest hours, the light of conscience must not and will not be extinguished. Acts of conscience by people of conscience will ultimately save us from ourselves.
Thanks for listening today. That was Dr. Charles Haynes giving one of his three presentations for the 2018 Walter B. and K.W. Sherden Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. For more on the series,
visit bjconline.org/Sherdin Lectures. For more podcasts, follow us on iTunes. Thanks for listening to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast.